Pre-Socratics, Part 3. The fourth talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 24, 2012, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 2 in this series.
I'm hopeful that we can finish the pre-Socratics today. What I've done to try to facilitate our discussion is make another chart. This will live alongside the other charts that I gave you, but this includes in brief form a little bit more information than you got on your other handouts. And hopefully those of you out in online land can download this off the website. We've already looked at, so what I want to do is what I think will be most at the heart of what we want to do in this class is to compare this with the biblical worldview. I want to do that eventually, but I'd like to get all these people in front of us first so that we know what we're talking about and so we have the information. So let's work down the second and third column here on your chart. We've already done part of it. We've looked at the Milesian school. On your left-hand column, Thales, the foundational principle, the ultimate reality that underlies everything is water. And everything else, the diversity of everything else in the world, arises from that water being able to be transformed into different forms. So water can become a solid, ice, it can become a gas, steam, water vapor. And then various, the idea is, whether you think it's reasonable or not, the idea is that everything else is some permutation of how water, what kind of form or what kind of shape water can take. Anaximander then says, I don't think it's water. I think it's this thing that he calls the indeterminate. The indeterminate contains all the opposites that exist in reality. Warm, cold, it's only opposites, I know, but whatever opposites there are in reality, they're all somehow contained in this thing called the indeterminate. And as they sort out of the indeterminate, they fall out, they get sifted out like a sieve sifts things, you get the many different things in reality and in the world. Anaximenes says that the ultimate reality is air, and he does the same thing with air that Thales did with water. If air gets really dense, it could be a solid-like substance like earth, or not so solid, it's water, or it can become very, very rarefied, and that becomes basically what we consider to be spiritual reality for him. So the interesting thing about Anaximenes is notice what he's doing. He's saying qualitative differences, like the difference between a solid and a liquid and a gas, qualitative differences are ultimately quantitatively determined. It's the density of air. So you could put a number on that, how many things per cubic inch, that number, that quantitative measure of the density of air actually translates into qualitative differences in the world. So all the different ways that things can be ultimately are from the one underlying reality that can be transformed and take on different forms by a quantitative change. Then we looked at the Pythagoreans, who argue that ultimately everything is made out of number. And it's probably more plausible than that sounds to us. When we think of number, we think of a completely abstract kind of idea. But numbers for them, they represented them in geometrical shapes. They have little, basically, here's the way to think about it, to update it. On our computer screen, we have pixels that determine everything that you see on the screen and the form that it takes. Each of those is a little unit. Each pixel is a little unit. Well, that's the Pythagorean view of reality. Everything is made up of little monads, little onesies, little units, units of one that are little drops of being, little units of being. And probably think of it that way, and I think you're getting closer to how they're imagining it. The number one itself, is one even or is one odd? Well, it's both, the Pythagorean said. You start with one, and then you just, if you add one more, you get an even number, but then add one more again, you get an odd number, and then add one more again, you get an even number. So one is neither even or odd. It can make something even, it can make something odd. It has both. It contains both within it. But everything is what they call the void, occupied by these little monads, these little units, little onesies. Okay, that's as far as we got. Now we get to Heraclitus. Heraclitus is interesting. He says that the ultimate foundational reality is fire, but it's fire that is constantly in flux, constantly changing in accord with what he calls logos. So reason, mind, is guiding the flux of fire, but everything is ultimately in flux. In fact, reality is such that flux, change, transformation, ongoing, recurring transformation is essential to the very nature of reality. Without flux, there could be no reality. He's the first one of these philosophers that's going to say anything quite so bold as that. He's famous for his little quip that I think Aristotle attributes to him, that you cannot step into the same river twice. And what he means by that is, isn't it interesting, although we look at a river and we say, that's the Willamette River, and it was the Willamette River yesterday, and it's the Willamette River today, there's something about it that makes us think of it as a determinate, identifiable thing, a unity, if you will, and yet you can't step into the river today that you stepped in yesterday. It's a different river because the unity that makes the Willamette River the Willamette River, whatever that unity is, underlying the unity of that river is a constant, ever-changing, fluctuating reality. And that's what he's saying the cosmos is. The cosmos is this ever-changing, fluctuating, transforming reality, ever-changing. It wouldn't be what it is if it weren't changing, is his contention. So his perspective is that everything is in kind of a balance. Fire is consuming everything, because notice that when you burn a fire, if you throw wood on the fire, it starts off being wood, but it ends up being fire and ashes, but let's ignore the ashes. You throw the log on the fire, and the log gets transformed into fire, but he argues out of fire, everything comes. Everything is created, and everything comes to be again. So the whole of reality is this ongoing cycle of everything being devoured by the flame, and then everything emerging again back out of the flame. And he has kind of a conservation of being principle, like our conservation of matter and energy principle, is that that's in this kind of balance where however much is being consumed and transformed into fire is reemerging again elsewhere in reality. So there's this just ongoing cycle of transformation. That's eternal, unending, doesn't have a beginning, will never have an end.
Does the sun have any part of his theory in terms of the
Absolutely, and fire I don't source? Remember exactly the specifics of what it is, but yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
It may be for him the center of reality into which everything is being incinerated. I don't remember exactly, but something like that. That's Heraclitus. Then we come to another major school called the Eleatic School. The Eleatic School is from Elea in Italy. Now, basically any intellectual activity in Italy or Sicily at this time, they're all Greek colonies. I mean, this is all Greek philosophy. It's just a matter of geographically where they are located. But the Ionians colonized pretty widely, and they had several colonies on the Italian peninsula and in Sicily. Well, Alea was one of those colonies and was a real center for intellectual activity. Parmenides and a student of his called Melissus, they created a whole new paradigm, a whole different kind of paradigm. What's the foundational principle of reality? Well, reality is just this one thing. It is eternal. It is unchanging. It is complete. It's a sphere. Reality is a sphere. Change doesn't exist. Now, obviously, he's got some splaining to do, so his way of explaining that is he makes a distinction between the way of truth and the way of belief or opinion, that how things appear to us is one way, how things actually are is completely different. With my mind, I can grasp how things are, and I'm going to use logic and reasoning and the tools of logical contradiction and that kind of thing to come to an understanding of how things actually are. But that's going to be different than how things appear to us. So certainly things appear to us like they change. I mean, that we all know that. But that's an illusion, he says, because even though they appear to us as they change, in fact, there is no change whatsoever. There's this static, eternal, unchanging, indestructible, complete sphere, and that's what reality is. The whole idea of the way of truth and the way of opinion, on the one hand, that's going to have a huge impact on Plato coming up. But on the other hand, and this is very interesting, and I have never really been able to trace it, it is fascinating how much the early Greek pre-Socratics are echoed in Eastern philosophy. You know, the Hindu concept of Maya, illusion, is very, very compatible with the kind of thing that Parmenides is saying here, that ultimate reality is what it is, and from that ultimate reality came this illusion that we live in. So the world of change and corruption and everything that we experience, that's Maya. It's not ultimately real. What's ultimately real is not subject to that kind of change and corruption and so on. And I don't know who influenced who. I don't know whether the East is influencing the Greeks, or whether the Greeks are influencing the East, or whether there's a whole lot more. My hunches, there's a whole lot more interchange and dialogue than we, from our vantage point, tend to think. Charlie has pointed out in his readings how much trade there was in the ancient world. And I won't get all this stuff right, but I remember he's commented that there's something that can only come from Southeast Asia that is a part of this, either the spices or the metallurgy of the Middle East, for example. So the trade routes, one way or the other, connected them with products that came all the way from Vietnam and Thailand and, you know, Southeast Asia. So we have kind of a, in our modern view, where you hop on an airplane and go around the world, we kind of have a view that they couldn't possibly, back then, without their airplanes, couldn't possibly have had much interaction with each other. But history seems to suggest otherwise. They also didn't have TV and video games, so they had a lot of time to travel. And however long it took them, they got there. And they exchanged ideas and products and stuff. If you've ever heard of Zeno's paradoxes, Zeno was also a student of Parmenides, and the whole purpose of his paradoxes was to basically lend support to Parmenides' idea that reality was an eternal, unchanging reality, and that change is an illusion. And he's not really proving anything by his paradoxes. He's just saying, you think that Parmenides' idea is absurd? Well, your idea is equally absurd. That is your idea that things can actually move and that things can actually change. So some of the more famous paradoxes, Achilles is in a race with a turtle, and he proves that Achilles can't possibly win the race because in order to catch up with the turtle, he has to go half the distance between the turtle and him. The turtle has a head start. He has to go half the distance. In the time that he goes half the distance, the turtle has moved. Now he goes half the distance again. In the time that he goes half the distance, the turtle has moved again. So he goes half the distance again. In the time that it took him to go half the distance, the turtle has moved. He has to go half the distance again. In the time that took him to go half the distance, the turtle has moved. He can never catch up. An arrow can't move because when you shoot an arrow, at any given point in the path, there's a spot where the arrow is at rest. So since the arrow is at rest in that spot, then the arrow is not moving. It can't be moving and not moving at the same time. So therefore, motion is an absurdity. There are about three things in philosophy that constantly get people writing articles on them. One of them is Zeno's paradoxes. As much has been written to try to solve Zeno's paradoxes as perhaps anything else, certainly in ancient history. Another one, and we'll hopefully get there, is Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God. People are constantly writing about that. It's not at all a valid argument, but finding out why it's not valid is tantalizing to people. And then the third one is a two-page paper written by an analytic philosopher in America within the last half a century, a guy named Gettier. And he created Gettier problems, and that's too complicated to get into right now. But more pages have been written about his essay than the essay itself. The essay was like about two pages, and people can't stop writing about them. So. But Zeno's paradoxes is one of those things that has managed to get a lot of ink over the centuries, because it's not immediately obvious how you solve the paradoxes that he presents. Well, that's the Eleatic school. Then we have Empedocles. He's from Sicily, another colony, another Ionian colony. He basically is taking the ideas of the earlier pre-Socratics and kind of adjusting their assumptions and coming up with his own. There's nothing particularly original in what he's doing except an original kind of an arrangement of the concepts. So he ends up with four elements and two forces. If there's anything original in Empedocles, it's that he recognizes the need. You can't just have elements that explain reality. You have to explain why they change. What makes them change? You can't just say they change. Why do they change and what makes them change? And so he contributes that. So there's four elements: air, earth, water, and fire. Notice all three of those have come from prior pre-Socratic philosophy. And what are the forces that go to work to bring about the transformation of these elements? And he doesn't see the elements themselves transforming. He sees them as combining with each other. And the relatively different proportions of air, earth, water, and fire in something makes a different kind of substance. And that different kind of substance creates a different kind of thing. So everything ultimately could be analyzed into proportions of air, earth, water, and fire. And what causes them to come together and be combined in the way they do? There's the force of love and the force of, sometimes you hear it translated hate, sometimes strife. But there's love and there's strife. Love is the attractive force, and strife is the force that separates, that repels, that drives apart. So all of reality, he's arguing, is ultimately being pushed and pulled by these two forces, love and hate, love and strife. And he seems to have a concept that there was a time in the history of the cosmos where love prevailed completely. And when love prevailed completely, you really kind of have a homogeneous soup of all the different elements of earth, water, air, and fire just all kind of commingle together in a happy soup, right? And that's when love has prevailed. But then hate, intruding from the outside, begins to repel. And as things repel, like particles join with like particles. And as like particles join with like particles, now you no longer have this homogeneous soup, but you begin to have things separating out and becoming distinct and determinate. And that keeps going until ultimately you have water over here, fire over here, air over here, earth over here, and there's no contact between them at all. There's no intermingling at all. And then love goes to work again and begins to attract the particles back toward each other until you finally come up with your happy soup again. So that is an endless, eternal cycle that goes on and on and on forever. Notice how much we have this recurring theme in the pre-Socratics. There is no beginning and there is no end. It's just this cyclical reality that keeps on chugging. Okay? Next one we get is Anaxagoras. Anaxagoras decided that it's not a matter of air, earth, water, and fire. Every distinctive substance has its own little minute invisible particle. So bone, stone, rose, you know, whatever. The question would be, how does he divide reality up? What makes a substance, but whatever things you can classify that the world are in the world, whatever your list of things is, each of those things has its own little invisible minute particle. And every object contains all the particles of everything. So, why does water appear to us as water? Because the particles of water predominate in that thing. But it's not only water that exists in the thing. That's why out of water can come earth or can come other things. I mean, like he's worried about when we eat food, the food that we eat doesn't have any hair in it, but it causes hair to grow. Where did the hair come from? The food we eat doesn't have any bone. It's not bone that we're eating. So where does the bone come from that grows in our body when we're not eating bone? And his answer is, well, yes, we are. We're eating hair and bone and everything else. We're eating the whole world and everything in it. It's just they're these tiny, tiny invisible particles of all those things, but you don't ever see them as such, because they are eclipsed by the preponderance of some other particles. And it's whatever the preponderance of particles are that dictate what it is that you experience the object as. So when you see a bone, it's because bone particles are predominating in that. But there's also hair particles in the bone. And Anaxagoras does one other thing that's unique now and interesting and really caught Socrates' attention. Socrates comments on this in one of his dialogue, because Anaxagoras realizes, how do you get things going and how do you get things started? And what it's kind of like the love and the strife, the love and the hate of Empedocles, but he attributes the motion to what he calls nous, and nous is one of the Greek words for mind, for reason. So Anaxagoras thinks that there's a mind that is ultimately the cause and the motive force behind all the change in the movement that brings about the world. Socrates says he was sorely disappointed, however, because even though he introduced this notion of nous, whenever he gave an explanation for everything, it was always a mechanical explanation. And what had intrigued Socrates is the fact that you would actually have purpose being introduced by a mind. And that's actually not what Anaxagoras ever does with it, at least not in any literature that is extant, or even any explanations of his views. Instead, he just uses mind to get it going, to get it started, to give it a beginning, and then he's done with it. Doesn't do anything else with it. But he does say of nous, nous is the only thing where the particles of nous are the only particles in nous. It's pure and uncorrupted with other particles. But that's the only pure substance in reality. Okay, and then finally, we come to the atomists. A man named Leucippus is probably the philosopher who gave rise to it. Democritus is much better known. He comes a little later and arguably may not actually be a pre-Socratic in the sense that he's before Socrates. But in the literature that we have, all their writings are combined, and it's hard to know who's saying what and what should be attributed to whom. So we treat them together as just sort of one view. They argue that ultimate reality is made up of little monads now, but they're called atoms. And the reason they're called atoms is because they are uncuttable. You cannot divide them. They are indivisible and they are indestructible. So you have these little units, little balls of being that have various shapes, irregular shapes, hooks on them, no rhyme, no reason. I mean, they're all different from each other. But what's distinctive about them is you can't divide them. And everything that exists is a conglomeration of these atoms that are all stuck together and fused together and welded together in various ways. Everything is made up of atoms. They are unlimited in number. They're infinitely small. And what you find among the atomists is they give only and always mechanical explanations of change. And there are no forces. There's no love. There's no hate. There's no nous for the atomists. It's just what we would call chance. And it's not clear whether Democritus himself had this view, but later Lucretius is going to describe, and he's much later, but he's an atomist. Lucretius comes along and says, "There's the in the beginning there was the void, and the atoms were simply floating and kind of traveling in parallel in the void." There's reason to think Democritus thought that it was more, that they were more random in the void. If you see a sunbeam coming through the window and the dust in the air, the way it kind of moves every which way in every direction, that seems that there's a very real possibility that that was Democritus's view. But Lucretius thinks they were all just running in straight lines and parallel in the void. And then, lo and behold, for some inexplicable reason, one of them swerved and caused this massive collision. And out of this collision came the world and everything in it. So I call it the big swerve. Okay. So any questions on any of the, that's enough to give you a feel for each of these pre-Socratic philosophers. Any questions on that before I want to compare them a little bit here?
I'm just really obsessing over this indeterminate thing.
Uh-huh.
What exactly is that?
It's really hard to know.
That's probably why I'm obsessing over it. I mean,
what I'm not sure from what I've read is, do you have a number of particles that are the indeterminate, called the indeterminate, or do you have one indeterminate? And different things I've read on it seem to steer me in different directions. So I'm not sure about that. I think what makes the most sense, because I think Anaximander has a vortex. A lot of these guys talk about a vortex causing things. So you've got this whirlwind that comes along and throws different things at different distances, and that's why you begin to get separation out and all that. I think Anaximander might have a vortex. So I think it's working on one thing. So the indeterminate is the collection of all the polar opposite kinds of concepts that you can think of. There's light, there's darkness, there's cold, there's heat, there's...
So rather than it being an element, it's like an abstraction?
I think, yeah, it's much more abstract, it seems to be, yeah.
So the universe is made out of concepts.
Concepts, yeah. But
indeterminate concepts.
But I don't think he's an idealist. That is, I don't think he thinks that reality is an idea rather than matter. All of these pre-Socratics seem to be some stripe of materialist, that they identify the substratum of reality as a thing, a material thing. But it's a weird kind of material thing. And that's what's really difficult for us in the 20th century to get a handle on, because we're reductionistic materialists. I mean, we think that everything that exists is made of electrons and subatomic particles and stuff like that, and that's really, when all is said and done, that's all there is. That's not what they're thinking, because for Thales, for example, magnets have souls. Well, what is that? You know, I mean, what does it mean for a magnet to have a soul if you're a reductionistic materialist? I don't think you can be a reductionistic materialist and think that a magnet has a soul. So they're materialists, but their material seems to be representational in nature. Water is not water, is not H2O, is not a particular molecule in our view. Water is something that represents something that's bigger and beyond it, and more inclusive than just H2O molecules.
And you said they don't have a beginning, but when you describe them, it sounds more like they have a beginning. It's just not a beginning ex nihilo.
Well, some of them have a beginning, although, it's a way that our present reality got started. It's almost like they're not even thinking past that or beyond that. The ones who do think past that and beyond that, they end up with a recurring cycle. It just always has been this way and always will be this way.
I have a question about Parmenides that might require some speculation.
Okay.
Is there any indication or even any chance that when he was talking about everything being a whole or a sphere, that, or a unity, an unchanging unity, that he was thinking, well, that time played a role in that? That is to say, he was thinking of everything, including including past and future, and that doesn't change? Was he like a fatalist in that way, sort of thing? Or is it, you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, to my knowledge, he doesn't address that. And that's part of the problem, is that we don't have there's so much of what they wrote that we don't have. So it's hard to say. But to my knowledge, he doesn't really address that. Let's go back to Parmenides a second. Why such a weird idea that there could be no change? The reason he has the concept that there could be no change is because he doesn't believe that not being can come out of not being, and not being can come out of being. So if something doesn't exist, then how could it like begin to exist? That's part of his thinking. And then when it comes to my knowledge, I can't know something that isn't. I can only know something that is. Now, it shouldn't be obvious to you that that's true, but you can see what he's thinking, is that if there's something there to be understood, then there's something there to be understood. There's something that exists. If it doesn't exist, then I can't know it. I can't have any understanding of it. And that's plausible if you think about knowledge in a particular kind of way. It's not plausible if you think about knowledge in another kind of way. But if you think of knowledge as a kind of touching, then it makes all the sense in the world. You can't touch something that's not there. You can only touch something that is there. And that seems to be his concept of knowledge, is knowledge is my mind touching something. apprehending it and literally grasping it so that I can make contact with it with my mind. Well, if you think of knowledge that way, then you see how his argument follows. You can't touch something with your mind if it's not there. So the mind, anything the mind can know is, and anything that the mind can't know isn't, or rather, if it isn't, the mind can't know it. So everything there to be known and seen and experienced and perceived is. And there's no time that it couldn't have not been, because where could it have come from? So it's there, because I see it, I experience it, I know it, I grasp it with my mind, and it had to always be there, because it can't come from nothing. So everything that is had to always be. That's his reasoning. So let me just comment on that a second. We're going to see over and over again in the history of philosophy that how you picture something to yourself affects the conclusions that you draw from it. And so what I mean by that, and if your picture is wrong, your conclusions are wrong. So if you picture knowledge as contact, as touching, and if you get stuck on that, it's contact, it's touching, and that's all it is, and that's everything that it is, then you're going to draw conclusions, as Parmenides did, that actually are contrary to common sense, even. I mean, it's not commonsensical that things don't come into being and that things don't change. I know they change. I know things come into being. So if my mind and my reasoning tells me they don't, then all the worse for my mind. Notice that's not how the pre-Socratics almost across the board think about it. The pre-Socratics are ready to set their common sense and their sense experience and their empirical data. They're willing to sweep that aside in favor of what their reasoning tells them. And we'll talk about that in a second. Later, we're going to get to Descartes. And Descartes is going to say, Descartes pictures knowledge like vision. To know something is to see something. I mean, we still use that metaphor very commonly in our language. Oh, I see. But he takes that with the utmost seriousness, that to know something is to see something, is to have a visual representation of something. So where Descartes goes with that is he says, if you envision, how do you know when a man is walking down a hill on a foggy day, and I look first and it looks like a tree stump, and then it looks like a tree stump moving, and then finally I go, oh, that's not a tree stump moving. That's a human being. That's a man. Well, how did I finally know what I knew? When my vision became clear. So clarity becomes the criteria for whether or not you really know something or not. It's clarity, because that's how it works in vision. So that must be how it works in understanding. Well, Descartes makes some huge mistakes because he thinks of thinking and understanding strictly and only according to that visual metaphor, and doesn't take into account the fact that we know in all kinds of different ways. Touching is different from smelling, is different from hearing, is different from tasting, is different from seeing, but they are all modes of knowledge, all ways of gaining information about the world and putting it together and thinking about it to come to understanding. And the only philosopher who really does full justice to that is the Scottish common sense philosopher Thomas Reid, I think, and that one of the things that helped him critique the whole system of philosophy before him was his appreciation of the fact that the logic of touching is different than the logic of vision, is different from the logic of hearing, and so on. But what has Parmenides done? He's made knowledge a very, very narrow, one-dimensional thing. It's if you can touch it, you know it. Well, not really. In vision, you don't touch anything, but you know it. in smelling something, you don't touch something, you don't make contact with it, but you know it. So knowledge cannot only be understood by the metaphor of touching. Question.
If, since this is true, that people are, all of these men are doing the same thing that Descartes did, that I'm, in some way or another, I'm looking at only one aspect of reality and willing to not, to deny mm-hmm. other aspects of reality that are apparent, what does it say to you about these people or about humanity?
If I were smart enough, it would be an interesting challenge to write the history of philosophy as the history of sin, the history of human rebellion against God, against reality, and against truth. I haven't given the time to analyze all that might go into it, but some of it is as simple and straightforward as, got this really novel, interesting, intriguing idea, and I'm getting a lot of attention on the rock star circuit. I mean, there are a couple of philosophers that we won't spend much time on, but a man named Spinoza and Leibniz, David Hume, they were literally the rock stars of their day. You know, wealthy families would have them into their home, and they'd have this dinner, and they would then sit there in the parlor and talk philosophy as entertainment. I mean, it was, and so the more you got invited to more people, you knew that you were a real hit. You know, you were a philosophical rock star. Well, if you have that kind of investment in your ideas, I mean, that's irresistible. You're not going to back down. You're not going to allow truth and common sense to trump your really fascinating idea that has a lot of entertainment value and gets you a lot of social affirmation, because that's a big deal to you. It's hard to say whether that's at play with the pre-Socratics, but I think it is. I mean, when we get to Socrates, Socrates' main antagonists are what are called the Sophists. We'll talk a little bit about them. And the Sophists were really self-impressed. They really thought that they were hot stuff. And how are they judging that? By how popular they are. How many people want to study under them or listen to them lecture or come and dialogue with them or whatever.
So my sin is, or their sin, our sin, is I'm willing to mess with people's minds in order to gain whatever prestige or exactly. place that I want in society.
Exactly.
And I would add that another side could possibly be I am so wounded that I have a need to create a reality distinct from what I see around me. And these are the people that we are talking about today
right.
and throughout history
right.
that are really unhealthy people.
Right.
So it might come from both sides.
I'm both a very
unhealthy person.
Right.
And I am a very sinful person. And you combine these together, It's not a good story that I'm hearing here.
That's right.
This is a really tragic lineup that you're giving us.
Yeah. No, that's it's not going to stop. I mean, the whole history of ideas, like I said, if I were smart enough, I'd like to write a book, The History of Ideas, The History of Sin. Because it really is the history of running from God, running from ourselves, running from reality. The last thing we want to believe is just face into the actual truth of how things are. And we will work really, really hard and use all of our brilliance to find a way to make it seem plausible that reality is not reality. And God is not there, and I am not sinful, and I am not frail, and not everything that we try to do. Yeah, it is.
So I'm hearing this, I'm thinking, hold the phone, these guys are Greeks, way back, they didn't have any science, and all they have is what's between their two ears. If somebody says, hey, you could reduce everything down to water, and I say, hey, you know, there's some consistency in that. Water comes out of a lot of stuff. I don't know what would make that automatically implausible if I'm some dude. I mean,
ask any four-year-old.
I mean, to some extent, but there's always, if you don't have, like, a way of scientifically quantifying it, it's simply an assertion that if you could scientifically quantify it, this is what it would come down to. And so without the tools of the technology we have today, it's an assertion that is in some way unfalsifiable, because the person on the other side can just say, we don't have the tools to quantify it, but if we could quantify it, this is what everything could be reduced to. So, I mean, thinking about it in that framework, I mean, that specific idea, everything being reduced to fire or water, I don't see why.
Well, you know. I don't think that's what Christina was talking about, though. What she was talking about is that move that thinkers are going to make over and over and over again, where their reasoning, and notice I'm not saying their reason, because it's not sound reason, but their reasoning takes them over here, and their common sense would take them over here. Well, what we ought to do when we're faced with that dilemma is go with common sense. But in the history of philosophy, over and over and over again, we're going to go with our reasoning over our common sense.
Would common sense necessarily teach me that everything can't be reduced
to water? No, and that's why I'm saying I'm not sure that's the example. That's the best example, because no, not necessarily. Okay. I mean, the problem with that claim is it's really difficult for us where we sit to even know exactly what he was thinking. Yeah. I mean, what do you mean everything is made of water? I'm not even sure I understand that. So it's hard to criticize something that I only inadequately. I can't adequately grasp.
This is a little bit of sidetrack. Is there a moral system attached to any of these folks, and was it influential in their cultures?
I think I would have to say no, not to any of these. We have a religious system attached to the Pythagoreans, because it's a kind of a carryover from the Orphic religion. So you do have, you know, don't eat beans, don't eat meat, keep yourself pure and purify your soul through contemplation and intellectual inquiry, which is a kind of a religious a concept of religious purity. But that's really religious purity. An actual moral system, if they had anything to say about that, we don't know anything about that. So I'm not aware of any.
Yeah, this is kind of a follow-up to one of the earlier questions on the fact that most, if not all, of the pre-Socratics were materialists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what would the difference between real materialism and like materialism of our day be that real materialism was religion still had a strong influence on it, while our materialism is completely divorced from religion?
Yes, I think so. Because I do think they still have one foot in the religious, sometimes even the polytheistic worldview that came from before them. So matter is not just matter. Matter is the God. And exactly what import that would have for them, we're just too far away to be able to. I can't get myself in that space mentally. But it does seem to me to be more than just stuff that we think of, the way we think of just stuff. The one exception of that is the atomists. It really seems like I'm straining to make their atoms gods,
because they offer nothing but mechanical explanations for everything. So they seem to be anticipating modern naturalism. I mean, notice when the scientists came along who developed atomic theory, they went back to the atomist for their word. That's where they got it. And it may very well be that we have here, it's really interesting because the atomism did not prevail in the ancient world. It was sort of a minority kind of marginal view. Today, it's the predominant view. Today, matter plus energy plus time plus chance is all there is. Well, that's essentially the atomist worldview, I think, unless I'm missing something. So they would be the one exception, I think, Michael, that everyone else has a kind of quasi-divine nature to their ultimate element, but I don't think the atomists do.
One more is, yeah, other than the indivisible, divisible aspect of atoms, what would you say is the difference between modern naturalists and the pre-Socratic atomists? Or is there any difference?
I'm sorry, modern what? And the
Naturalists.
I mean, obviously, we've become more sophisticated in our concept of atoms, but other than that and beyond that, the basic philosophical worldview looks very similar to me. Now, we have energy. We have the interchange of matter and energy that the atomists do not have, right? I mean, all there is this little indestructible little ball of being for them, whereas we have this energy can be transformed into matter and matter can be transformed into energy, and so there's interplay between matter and energy in our view. But if you just put matter and energy together, then what exists for the modern naturalist? Matter, energy in the void over time. That's the same as the pre-Socratic atomists, essentially.
Is there any morality with the love and hate?
No, not
right and wrong of that at all?
He talks about interpersonal relationships, but only enough to say it's the same force at work. So I don't think there's probably not really. In fact, there's in what I was reading, I'm trying to remember, but some of the commentators on that argued that it's more like Eastern religions, good and evil is all the same. You know, just it's not no reason to prefer one over the other. They're just both realities within the one that exists, the thing that exists. So, no, I don't think so. Yeah. Ella had a...
I just had a thought about what...
Andrew, is it?
Yes. Well, and about the relationship between what you were saying about man's rebellion and the history of ideas. And it reminded me of when I've listened to you before talk about the Bible and the exercise of reading the Bible, how we have a perfect text in front of us. And so when we face a conflict within the Bible itself, the conflict is not within the truth of the Bible, it's within my understanding.
Right.
And my willingness to confront that conflict will ultimately develop my depth of understanding.
Right.
And essentially in philosophy, what you have is individuals who are seeking to understand an ultimate truth. And my thoughts go in a couple different directions here, but one is that if we, as believers, come from the perspective of believing there to be ultimate truth, then in the study of the history of ideas, any progression of thought that does not ultimately end in the conclusion of ultimate truth that is more multifaceted than a single, than existence being reduced to an element such as water, then somewhere along the way we have compromised because we have failed to reach that conclusion.
Yeah, I think so.
And then the other thing that I was thinking is that there's always, between science and belief, between philosophy and belief, any sort of intellectualism, there's an antagonistic kind of relationship. And it divorces, what I see as one of the fundamental failures with this, with philosophy here, as what we've been talking about so far, is its failure to see truth or love or human relationship as a fundamental reality. It divorces those two. And you can't reduce human existence down to an element when so much of human existence is something that is not physiological or physical. Mm-hmm. And so that alone is a failure to acknowledge.
That's right.
Truth.
Yeah. And we'll get to Socrates maybe next week. That's going to be a fundamental part of his critique, is really that's what you're interested in? that there's so much more to human existence than what am I made of? You know, that how is that even interesting? Yeah. Okay, guess I'm going to have to let you go. So we'll finish up a little bit on the pre-Socratics and then go on and talk about the Sophists and set the stage for Socrates next week.